The Society for the Advancement of Sexual Health estimates that 3 to 5% of the American population suffers from some type of sexual addiction disorder. Sexual addiction, when a person can't manage their sexual behavior, can wreak havoc on work, family, and mental health. What causes this problem in the first place? How do we know if we or a loved one is addicted to sex? And how do we find the treatment that can help? I'm Susan Wilson, and today on Central Standard, we focus on understanding sex addiction and learn how the sexually addicted and their partners can get the help they need. Join the conversation right after this hour's news. Now more than ever, our society seems preoccupied with sex. Sexting and twerking are part of our lexicon. Whether we're talking about television, popular music, or movies, sexual images and innuendo are everywhere. And access to pornography is as easy as a click of a mouse for the over 40 million people who log into porn websites. Given the highly sexualized society we live in, can a person really become addicted to sex? And at what point does sex become an unhealthy addiction, a bad habit that interferes with work, relationships, and mental health? This is Central Standard, and I'm Susan Wilson. Today, we're talking about how a growing number of people are grappling with sexual addiction. We will explore the causes and the treatment available to help the sexually addicted and their partners. Joining us are Dr. Barbara Steffens, certified clinical sexual addiction specialist and author of Your Sexually Addicted Spouse, who works with partners of the sexually addicted. She joins us from studios in Cincinnati. Welcome to Central Standard, Dr. Barbara.
Oh, thank you very much. So happy to be here.
And also with us, Dan Gabbard, who specializes in counseling men. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Good morning, Susan. Very good. Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about how the two of you began focusing on sexual addiction. Dan, how did it begin for you?
Susan, I was actually working with a 24-year-old female client during my internship. She presented with a lot of alcohol issues, and as we dug into what was really happening in her world, what we found was she was drinking and then going to bed with guys, different men, on a regular basis. And I'm not really sure why, but it just hit me. I asked the question, what's it like when you're with these guys? We hadn't talked about it before, and she said, all my anxiety goes away. And that model of sort of a self-medication hypothesis for addiction, life gets really hard. I can't deal with this anxiety. So for her, sex was her escape and her release. I knew at that point I better learn about sex addiction or I wouldn't be able to help her.
Now, Barbara, how about for you? How did it begin?
Well, how I put this is it's not a specialty that I chose, but one that chose me. I was a happy practicing therapist in the greater Cincinnati area, and due to just a personal episode in my life, it started me on a journey of trying to find resources and support and help for people who find themselves in a relationship with someone who is sexually addicted. And at that time, I found that there was very little to no good information and help and support for the partner or spouse. So over the years, I just kept digging away, eventually did some research on partners, and that has led to now my specialty and a book and a pretty thriving practice. There's a lot of partners of sex addicts out there.
Well, who knew? And that begs the question, you know, you hear about sexual addiction in a different way and talked about more often today than maybe you did 20 years ago. Is sex addiction a new epidemic, or is it just becoming more recognized, or are these societal forces where we have much more sexualization going on a factor?
You know, Susan, I think it's probably a combination of what you mentioned. You know, there was a time if you wanted to look at pornography, it was very difficult, right? You had to drive to a video store. You had to buy a video or rent a video. take it home, view it, then go back to the video store. There was some embarrassment maybe in going. Or you'd go to the local pharmacy and have to ask the pharmacist if you could have one of those magazines that he kept behind the counter. All that's changed. And today, when you look at accessibility with the internet, pornography can be downloaded to a phone, can be downloaded to a tablet. You can use your tablet at work without going through the work network, so nobody knows that you're doing it. It's free. You can find almost anything you want without having to pay for it. And it's, again, widely available, any kind, any type, anything. So when you look at kind of those, we call them the three A's, the accessibility, the affordability, the availability, it's really sort of made anybody that had an inclination towards pornography, now it's just so easy to get, it's becoming more and more and more prevalent.
Now, Barbara, I'm sure you've heard people say, you know, I don't believe all this sexual addiction stuff. You know, it's really not an addiction just because I like sex. What do you say when you hear those kinds of things?
Well, I struggled with that myself. So I had to work through this as I looked at the constellation of behaviors that we understand now as sex addiction. And I tried to compare it to other kinds of addictions that I've seen in my practice and in life and in other relationships. And when you look at the compulsive nature of the behavior, the fact that it takes over the energy and the drive of the individual, that so much of their energy and time is spent being preoccupied with when am I going to have the next sexual encounter. And then when you look at the negative consequences that start to develop in the life of the person who's doing these behaviors, those are all hallmarks of an addiction. We see that, we understand that with substance abuse, even with gambling. And the same things are occurring. Sex is being used as a drug to alter mood, and it has horrific consequences.
And we're going to talk about some of those consequences in a minute, but What's the difference, Dan, between a strong sex drive, as some people might say that they have, and a sexual addiction?
Yeah, it's a great question. I hear that with clients a lot of times. You know, I just have a more active libido than other people do. And I think Barbara touched on it. You know, it's when you look at the consequences. Let me back up a second, Susan. What we see when you look at the addictive cycle is life gets kind of hard. I get stressed, I get depressed, I get angry, anxious, whatever it is, and I need an escape. When you use sex or gambling or drugs as that escape, there's a very known process, a cycle that we get stuck in. When someone uses sex as a way to escape daily life, the things that you and I may say, you know, gosh, it's been kind of a rough day. I'll take a little run or I'll breathe through it or I'll, you know, whatever I do, talk to somebody about it, get it out. Others will turn to sex as sort of that way to medicate. When those behaviors become the de facto way to manage my life, we're in trouble now. And it's more addictive than, you know, I'm just a more sexually active person than someone else.
So what you're saying is, you know, you have a problem when it's really starting to impact your life in a negative way, your daily living, your work, your relationships with others.
If you look at so in the mental health profession, we use the big book called DSM. It's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So the DSM. When you look at any other addictive diagnosis, the DSM will say things like it needs to impact your social, relationship, familial, professional, financial world. And people say, you know, I got drunk last night, I was hungover, I called in to work, I didn't go to work, I didn't get paid. It's pretty easy to see what that impact is. And I think as Barbara mentioned, you know, someone will get into a sexual addiction, they'll fantasize, they'll daydream. It still has an effect on their world, but we don't notice it because from the outside, you can't see that the person's, you know, hungover or that they're struggling. But on the inside, and what we end up doing in therapy is really digging in and finding where those impacts are, and then we're able to say, is this just bad behavior, a slip-up, or is this addictive?
You know, Barbara, there's been a number of high-visibility cases where public figures were involved in things like sexting or, you know, other kinds of sexual behaviors. And I guess the lay public says, you know, to themselves, it's hard to understand how logical people, knowing the consequences, they've seen what's happened to other people in public places who have done these things, why people would continue to risk ruining their reputation through sexting or other things like that. Is sexting just a fad, or is it a sign of an addiction in these cases?
I think in a lot of cases, sexting is just one more way that the person is seeking that sexual high. And again, because of technology right now, that's a really easy way to do that, to have access to other people and to act out. So if we call it a fad, it's only because of the technology that we're using right now. If some other form of interpersonal communication comes up in the next 5 years, we'll be utilizing that as another way of acting out. So no, it's not a fad. And I think in terms of if an individual sees public figures doing this, and you would think a wise, intelligent person would say, boy, I don't want that happening to me. But part of the process of any addiction is an eroding of being able to think clearly. We describe it as being in a really crazy place, not thinking clearly. If they were thinking clearly, they wouldn't be doing the things that they're doing. And they start to develop this kind of cushioned belief around themselves, saying, well, that'll never happen to me, or I'm not as bad as another person. So they start to rationalize, minimize the impact, and it's just a slippery slope slide down to really destroying their lives.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and our guests are Dr. Barbara Steffens, author and certified clinical sexual addiction specialist who works with partners of the sexually addicted, and also Dan Gabbert, who specializes in counseling sexually addicted men. We're focusing on understanding sex addiction, its causes and treatments. Do you believe that sex can be addicting? And at what point is there a problem? Kansas City, join the conversation by calling us 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So for those skeptics who think that this kind of sexual addiction can't be a problem, what are some of the negative impacts you've seen on people's lives, Dan?
You know, Susan, they are across the board. I've had people coming to me telling me about financial woes, you know, money spent on prostitution, money spent on... I had a gentleman one time, I want to say he was upwards of 20 porn sites that he was spending roughly $60 a month on. So you do that math over a 2-3 year period, very short time, but the money adds up significantly. He ended up losing his apartment at the time, I think 2 years out of college maybe, and having to move back in with mom and dad. You know, marriages that break up, my wife takes my children away from me. There's a big difference between someone who is addicted and someone who is offending. But a lot of times the questions that race through a partner's mind get into things like, my husband has this this addiction. Are my kids at risk? Am I at risk? Now you start getting into sexually transmitted diseases, health issues that come up from acting out. Again, health, financial. I've had at least 3 or 4 gentlemen who've said, you know, didn't think twice about it. It just became my normal routine. But I got found out at work. And next thing you know, I lose my job.
Because it's true that some people who are sexually addicted will even access porn sites at work, which is usually against company policy.
Oftentimes, I'll either see they're doing it on company time using company resources, the company computer, the company internet, or what I'm finding much more common is a guy will set his office so that he can have his iPad out. It's connected over a cellular network, so he's avoiding the company resources, but he's still losing 3 or 4 hours of productivity in his day. Then he wonders why he gets a bad review or he loses his job. It's not necessarily because of his addiction. It's because his addiction kept him from being effective at work.
Barbara, what have you seen in terms of impacts? I know you work particularly with couples.
I work primarily with the partner, so the person that's in that intimate relationship with the person who's addicted.
How does it affect them?
Wow, it is my research really showed that the finding out about the hidden sexual behaviors, the addiction, is actually traumatic for the partners. So they end up experiencing what we would understand as symptoms consistent with post-traumatic stress disorder. Many of them do. They go into shock. They're hypervigilant, where they're scanning the environment all the time for threats. They go on the computer, and they want to check and see if their husband's been acting out. So it starts to take over a lot of energy in their lives. They become highly anxious, very, very fearful. As Dan touched on, they get afraid for their children, for their own physical safety. The risk of getting a sexually transmitted disease, HIV, is real for these partners. And so they feel their very life and their livelihood has been threatened once they find out. And a big hallmark of this addiction versus some of the other addictions is this usually occurs in secret. So the partner generally knows nothing about the acting out, or they know very little. They may have this sense that something's not right. And then suddenly, most women find this themselves. They stumble upon information, and they have the shock of their life. It's devastating for the partner.
Dan, you had a comment.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important to note as well for the addict, I mean, much of what Barbara said, or all of what Barbara said, is absolutely true for the partner, and it's hugely devastating. In one of my groups, you know, we've talked about what's the impact that your addiction has had on you or on others. And a lot of guys will start with a position of, you know, I don't get what the big deal is. The wife and kids were in bed. It was just a little alone time, a little me time. I'm on the computer. It's not really hurting anybody. But what they often come to through therapy is, I've led a double life. I've kept this secret. I've not been genuine or authentic in my relationship. I've not been able to be present for my family, for my kids. I've not been the kind of husband or father or partner that I want to be. And that impact is sort of that hit rock bottom for a lot of people.
Now, Barbara, what are some of the warning signs that you tell partners of the sexually addicted to look for? Because I think part of the difficulty here is that at first this is really well hidden.
Yes, it is. It's hidden. And for a lot of partners, before they discover the addictive behaviors, they had a sense that something wasn't right. There's a distancing that happens, maybe an increased irritability. Not knowing where your partner is, they disappear for periods of time, or they can't give a good explanation of use of finances. So once the partner knows about the sexual addiction, they can look back in history and make a little more sense about, you know, what had been going on. And then those become some of the indicators for looking for now, is the addiction continuing? The main thing I ask partners to look for is changed behavior over time. That, as Dan was talking about, when discovery happens and the person with the addiction goes into treatment, they're not automatically going to make this miraculous breakthrough where all of a sudden they are healed. It is a slow, tedious process of recovery for them. So for the partners, that's a very uneasy time. They want to know, am I safe or not? Is he acting out or not? So I work with them to look at the larger behaviors of being honest, of being predictable, of being consistent, of doing what they say they're going to do, an increase in integrity. But I also encourage partners to ask for openness. It's hard to be in a relationship with someone where there's secrets and hiddenness. So I ask them to watch for how open is your spouse becoming. How honest are they becoming? How often do they come to you and tell you about their recovery process? Because those are the best indicators.
Now, and I know this is hard to say, but based on your work with the spouses of the sexually addicted, Barbara, what percentage of these marriages can actually sustain themselves when sexual addiction occurs? Does a lot depend on whether the person can easily recover from their sexual addiction, or are there cases where once this happens, the marriage is never the same?
That's a very good question and a very difficult question to answer because just as you started to say, there are so many variables involved in whether or not a marriage can survive. Most of that depends upon the commitment of the person with the addiction to their own recovery. Usually when people start out in recovery, they're doing it because they got caught, they're in trouble, they want to put everything back together again. And recovery won't work with that motivation for very long. So a marriage can survive with when the individual with the addiction really takes personal responsibility for their own recovery, whether or not the relationship survives. They have to want it for themselves. So if they do that, and then they take responsibility for rebuilding what has been broken because of their behaviors, and they work really hard to have empathy and connection for the people that they have harmed, that lays the foundation and the groundwork for the relationship to be able to heal. But even with all those wonderful things in place, sometimes for the partner, that betrayal trauma, that wound that they've experienced is just too hard to get past to think about staying in a relationship with someone that they now know has the capacity to deceive them and betray them. If both people do very hard work at restoring openness and honesty in the relationship, I have all the hope in the world that a relationship can survive. But I tell couples, this is the work of your life. This will take everything you have to do this hard work.
Because I imagine just like addictions to drug and alcohol, you're never really truly recovered. It's something that you have to watch the rest of your life. Is that true, Dan?
Yeah, I think you hit on a really great topic. I've heard people who have been in recovery around cocaine say, 12, 14, 15 years in, I woke up one night and had this taste or this sensation in my mouth that was just like I had been using again. And that same kind of a feeling often is still in place many years later. I have a few clients who are 5 to 7 years into recovery, and it's really strengthened and changed their relationship significantly. You know, Susan, one thing that we haven't talked about, I think, you know, Barbara and I have talked about this a little bit in the past, this is as much an intimacy disorder as it is about sex. It's about not being able to feel really open and vulnerable and intimate with your partner. And so the addict searches out other ways to kind of fill that need, and unfortunately, they're never effective. So it's rebuilding that intimacy, the trust, the things Barbara was talking about, that is so painful and hard for the addict, because this is a place, a feeling, a sense, a vulnerability that they have never been into in their life probably.
So when you say an intimacy disorder, you're talking about the inability to really get close to people.
Let people in and share and be open, as Barbara mm-hmm. was talking, and really be that close to someone. Mm-hmm. Believe that that person will love me and be with me and stay with me, even if they knew all the bad things I think about myself. And so I don't really allow myself to go there in my relationship, so now I've created this kind of gap in my life, and I go seeking that in other places, and I try to fill it through pornography, prostitution, any way I can, because we all have that real need. It's a matter of how do I get that filled? Ideally, that's in your relationship, but not everybody can go there.
And Susan, sometimes when the person with the addiction kind of gets that awareness that they have been disconnected from people, and they start to heal in their recovery process, and so they long to connect and bond with their partner now. And unfortunately, for a lot of partners, that's the very time that they want to put up their walls and shield themselves, because now this person that they thought they knew, that they longed to be with, has hurt them worse than anyone ever has. And so they have fear of responding to that desire for intimacy. So it's not an easy path. Both individuals are not going usually at the same speed. I always tell them that they're going in the same direction. Generally, the person with the addiction has a head start. They started way before because they knew about the behaviors. And now that they're in recovery, they feel great. They feel free. They're excited about moving forward. And for the partner, it's as if a landmine just went off in their home. And they're still trying to put pieces together, while this person that said they loved them and lied to them now wants to draw close. So it's a very, very complicated recovery process. And Dan and I both would say, if this is happening to you, you really need professional assistance to get through both the recovery process for both individuals and then for the relationship. This is not to be done alone.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. And we want you to join the conversation. What do you think about this topic of sexual addiction? Join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Just the way Greg and Waldo did. Now, Greg has a question for you today. He says, it sounds like all the references about persons with addiction are male. Is this a behavior that is exclusive to men, or are there women who also struggle with sexual addiction?
It's a great question, Greg. I don't know exactly why we do this, but I think for most folks working in this space, we tend to refer to the addict as the male and the partner as the female. The numbers are a little in flux, but I've seen as high as 70% of folks with a sex addiction are male and as low as about 60%. So there is absolutely a critical component of folks struggling with this addiction who are men, but also who are female.
Well, do men and women express their sexual addiction in a different way?
It's a great question, Susan. Yeah, what we find, and this doesn't necessarily come as a shock, I think, to most folks, men are much more visual, much more tactile. They'll act out much more frequently. Women, what I've seen at least, tend to be much more sort of emotional and more cerebral. So women will do more chat rooms and kind of fantasy kind of acting out. They're looking more for a relationship, a place to go. And again, not always, but that tends to be the general rule. I have men who are more love and relationship addicts, really seeking that approval, but I also have men who are just acting out sexually. So it's not a cut and dry kind of a situation. A lot of that goes back to we can look at different factors that happen in people's lives that create this addiction, and that helps us to really pinpoint what it is. But men and women do tend to act out differently.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, I was going to talk about the male partner. Again, I usually use she when I'm talking about the partner because clinically that's who we generally see. Just like it's very difficult for men who are in an abusive relationship to reach out and get help, it's very difficult for a man who is married to a female sex addict to reach out and get help. There's embarrassment. There's an increased sense of shame. It's hard for a female partner to reach out for help. Much more difficult for males. I've seen male partners, and I may have them come in three or four times to get information, and then they don't stay to work through the process. A lot of those marriages do not survive.
And do you see male spouses being a lot less tolerant of their wives' sexual addiction? Because of all the societal mores about being female and sexuality?
In the ones that I have worked with, I see a mix of tolerating it, trying to control it, just like a female spouse might do. And then I also see males who just say, I can't tolerate this, and they end the relationship. So, again, it's really going to depend on the individual, and I think it really depends on how much help and support they get to help them think through their decision-making and to understand the addiction as a way of understanding the behavior. It's very normal, and it's a first response when we find out that someone that we love is sexually betraying us. To think that somehow has some reflection on us as individuals. And so for a male partner and a female partner, one of the first things they have to start to understand is the behavior is not a reflection of, you know, them as an individual, the partner, but it's an acting out of the pain of the person with the addiction. So because they take it so personally, which is, again, totally understandable. It's very easy to just pull into themselves and to not reach out. So I think it's much harder for the guys to reach out for help when they've been betrayed.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be delving into the causes and treatments that give hope to the sexually addicted and the people who love them. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Susan Wilson. Our guests today are Dr. Barbara Steffens, certified clinical sexual addiction specialist who works with partners of the sexually addicted, and Dan Gabbard, who specializes in counseling men with sexual addiction. We're talking about sexual addiction and how it may be related to sexual abuse and other life problems. How are you? How about you? Do you or a loved one struggle with sex addiction? How are you addressing the problem, and what helps? Kansas City, tell us your thoughts by calling us, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or post your comments to Facebook or Twitter. We're at KCUR-CST. Well, we have a caller on the line who has a question. So good morning, Kristen from KCMO. You want to ask a question about a spouse affected with sexual addiction?
Yes, I just wanted to, and not as much a question maybe as a statement and just more kind of reaching out to folks who may be going through this and just the importance of getting that help. This is something that I went through with my first husband 10 years ago, and it's something that it's a situation you never think you'll be in. And you start questioning everything about yourself and your worth and how you look, and you think that you're unattractive and fat and nobody would want you, and you start really going through that yourself, and it takes a long time to get past that and to start seeing yourself. It just affects you so much. And so it was just kind of more of a statement of please make sure you do get help. I mean, the things that that you're both saying today are so true, and I loved what you said earlier about always scanning for a threat. I mean, 10 years later, it took a good 5, 6, 7 years to finally be at the point where I can watch a TV show that might have someone scantily clad and not want to just throw up. You know, it's just so important to get that help and to be able to take care of yourself, even if, you know, you're not able to make the relationship work out. So
right. So, Barbara, is this a common reaction? She mentioned, you know, a loss of self-esteem and feeling like I'm just not attractive enough, I'm not a good enough wife. Is this a common reaction for spouses?
It's an extremely common reaction. And I want to thank Kristen for calling in and encouraging women and sharing out of your own story. That was really courageous. And when I'm working with partners, one of the best things I find is the way they encourage and support each other. But yeah, when a person finds out that there's been sexual acting out, it's we understand it as addiction. But for the partner, they experience it as betrayal and infidelity. And they can really experience it as a personal rejection. So like I was saying before, part of that early work is understanding that it really is not about a rejection of the partner, of the spouse. But it's still that kind of wounding. It's a traumatic wounding for a partner in her sexuality, in her sense of who she is as a person. It can be traumatic to her own sense of her history. I've worked with partners who, once discovery has occurred of the behaviors, they found out that perhaps their husband or their wife was acting out during major life events, like on a honeymoon, or at the birth of a child, or while on vacation. So even that partner's sense of her own history gets distorted and traumatized. So part of that work is putting the pieces back together on what is her history, what is her reality, and how was it impacted by things that were going on that she didn't know anything about. But a lot of that work early on is getting back in touch with who are you as a person and how that is not damaged or changed by the actions of another person. To take that power back sometimes is lost in a trauma.
I would point out we have another email from another woman who said she thought that her husband said he needed a good wife and he would be okay, but that it so damaged the trust. And that's why I think your point is well taken, that help for the spouse is just as important for help just as important as help for the sexually addicted. Now let's talk causes, because that's something we haven't talked about. We talked about intimacy disorders, But what causes this type of intimacy disorder and the addiction that springs from it? Is it that the person has a mental health disorder that's underlying? Or what are the causes, Dan?
Yeah, great topic. I love this one because it's one of those things where when I explain sort of the ideology, how this develops, people can say, well, some of that happened to me, yet I don't have this addiction. What happened? But what we know is in most of these that I'm going to talk about are 85 to 90% plus of people that self-define as sex addiction. We know that they've had some early life sexual exposure. Now, that's usually pre-10 or 11 years old, pre-teen for sure. That might be they've witnessed a sexual act by parents. They were exposed to pornographic video, pornographic materials, some touching, fondling. There's some early sexual exposure. We also know that they typically have either very rigid or very lax boundaries and rules. So what that means is they either don't develop a sense of how to make those decisions and boundary decisions for themselves, or they're able to disregard them if they're lax and they have this, the rules don't always apply to me. We know that they have very disengaged parents, kind of a lack of role model. So at a young age, you're exposed to pornography, let's say. There are no rules, and you have no role model. It sets you up for making some really bad decisions. We also know that there's often an original wound, some abuse or some kind of shock to their psyche. That can be abandonment, sexual abuse, something that kind of rocks a child's world. And from that point, they try to patch that wound, and they know that pornography or sex feels good. They turn to that as the tool to patch up that wound.
We're going to take a caller at this point. Frank from Independence, you have a comment about sexual addiction.
Yes, I'm a sex addict also, and went through a turmoil with my wife about 3 years ago. And we worked it through and worked it out, but I find myself falling back into the same old routine. And I was wondering if there is somebody in Kansas City that I could talk to or get in touch with that would help me understand this and try to control it.
Well, Frank, first of all, I really want to commend you for coming on the air and admitting this. Do you notice what causes you to get back in the routine?
Well, just like the gentleman was saying, I had some early preteen sexual experiences, and it seems to haunt me constantly, and it goes very deep. And luckily, I love my wife dearly, and she's very understanding, but she still does not satisfy me sexually. So I need some kind of understanding of why.
So, Dan, what advice would you give to Frank?
Yeah, it's a really interesting case, Frank. And again, I would say the same. Bold move to reach out and not only ask for help, but to do so in such a public forum. So kudos to you for having that courage. What we've seen, Susan, often is folks who are in recovery long term and having successful recovery tend to do a handful of things that folks who relapse frequently don't. One is individual therapy, to really work through what's at the root of this issue. The second is group therapy. There is so much shame around this addiction that people feel really shameful, embarrassed about talking about it. But then there's this paradox to shame that when you sit down in a group and you say what's going on in your life, some of that shame starts to melt away, especially when group members can relate to where you've been. 12-step attendance, an S group, an S-Anon, or an SAA, an SA group, something like that. Again, some of that support.
And you're talking about SA is sexual addiction.
So there are several S groups out there. There's an SA, an SLA, sex and love addiction, SAA. They're all a little different the way they approach the addiction. I always tell my guys, you know, the best thing I can tell you to do, go online, find a couple meetings, go someplace that you feel comfortable and you fit. Having a sponsor through one of those groups for sometimes, as Frank, the caller, was talking about, you know, I have this need, this urge to act out. I need my sponsor that I can call and say, you know, hey, buddy, I'm thinking about it. Talk me down and keep me on the right path. So that sponsor, a support network, individual group therapy, those are the things that we see over time really keep people in recovery.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and with us is Dr. Barbara Steffens, certified clinical sexual addiction specialist who specializes in trauma therapy for partners of sex addicts, and Dan Gabbert, who specializes in counseling sexually addicted men. We're discussing sex addiction and the problems it creates for relationships and society as a whole. Have you or a loved one struggled with sex addiction? And what was helpful for you in overcoming the problem? Kansas City, join the conversation by calling us 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, I have a question here also. What's the relationship between someone who has a sexual addiction and someone who's a sexual offender, or is there a relationship?
Yeah, good question. I'm going to ask Barbara to weigh in this one, too, but I'll give you my take on that, Susan. The two are not necessarily connected, and what I mean by that is I don't actually work with offenders. So my guys have an addiction. They'll tend to act out with pornography, prostitutes, willing, adult affair partners, that sort of thing. The offender population, that offender may have an addiction, but there's more to their acting out. It can be the power differential. It can be anything that is unwanted or that the other person may try to fend off. So there's a different mindset with the offender. I don't work there. I don't have a really great understanding of it. Some offenders are addicts, but not all addicts are going to be offenders.
Barbara, what do you say about this?
I would say the same thing. With a sex offender, there's this crossing a boundary to injure another person. A person who's a sexual addict, their motivation is not to harm. Their motivation is not to use as an object in terms of harming somebody else. It's not criminal in nature. It is definitely using people, but it's using people as in terms of their fantasy. But it's not to harm another individual. Now, some people who are sexual addicts do develop offending behaviors where they cross that line. And again, I don't treat those, but I have worked with partners of sex offenders. And for the partner, the experience is very similar, except there's also that added weight of potential criminal charges and those kinds of long-term effects for the relationship and for the reputation of the individual. So say a partner's married to someone who sexually offended children, then for that partner, she takes on this incredible shame and isolation of being with someone who would harm a child. So it's even more devastating for the family member when there is a sexual offense.
We have Brooke who's writing in, and she says she's a female recovering sex and love addict. Her behaviors included manipulating and managing multiple relationships and affairs on a regular basis with colleagues, bosses at work, neighbors, friends, roommates, etc., ranging from sexual relationships to emotional bonding. And then she goes on to say that she attended support groups and went to therapy, and she had to really change her thinking about this. What about this particular element of combining sex addiction with also love addiction that includes not just sex but emotionally bonding with other people? Barbara, have you seen this pattern?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we see that a lot. And what this caller is describing is very common with female sex addicts. So there's a combination of using their own sexuality as kind of their power to have control, that seduction process of another person, but then also that wanting an emotional connection with the person. I was just listening to someone present on female sex addiction last week, and she talked about how for a lot of female sex addicts, they do these sexual behaviors hoping that on the other side of it, that somehow or another this person will want them and they'll have a relationship. So they're striving after this wanting to have a connection, but then also at the same time, perhaps wanting to have power and control over another person, rather than having someone hurt them. So you think about a male seducing and having control and manipulating a female. A woman who has experienced that will then may want to turn and do that same kind of behavior to men so that they're the ones that have the power and the control. So I hope that you're hearing in these scenarios that this really isn't about sex. It's about changing their mood, feeling some sense of power or adrenaline rush, risk-taking, but it really is not about sex drive.
So let's talk about the therapies that are available. If a person has a sex addiction, Dan, what should they expect in terms of the treatment that's available? What does that look like?
Yeah, great question. The way I do it is we sort of divide it into two pieces. So part of a sex addiction is behavioral. And so we drop a contract that says, here are the activities, the behaviors that I'm committing to stop. I'm not going to go online. I'm not going to look at pornography. I'm not going to cruise for partners, whatever those behaviors are. Then we start to dig into, and what's the root cause? And so as you look back over the things that I mentioned earlier, right, early sexual experience, what did that mean to you as a child? How did that protect you, help you? How did that shape where you're at today? We need to unpack a lot of that old baggage and start to really rework it. Oftentimes, there's an original wound that has a trauma effect to it. I've worked with a gentleman in the past that remembered his father leaving when he was about 3 or 4 through a divorce. Just one day dad was gone and found his father's pornography stash. So he connected these two things, his longing for a parental role model. You added to that the abandonment and then the excitement of this is the only thing I have left of dad. There was a lot of work to do there to reshape how he thought about women, sexuality, men, role models. Once we understood all that, we were able to sort of start doing the rebuilding effort, you know, and he's been, that I'm aware of, in recovery for about 12 months now. So we dig back through, you know, what caused this, and then we've got the kind of reparative work that starts to happen. Everybody's a little different, of course, but most of the time we end up with some trauma work, some rebuilding about self-esteem, what I believe about me to be true, and then also relationship.
Now, Barbara, how about you? When you work with spouses, what kinds of work do you do to get them to be healed from the trauma of discovering sexual addiction?
We usually start out with crisis-oriented counseling. When you think about a partner finding out about hidden sexual behaviors, in my research we showed that on average it was discovered after it had been going on 14 years in a relationship. So that's a long time for there to be a secret going on and impacting the partner. So she's in crisis or he is in crisis. They're dealing with what is this, what just happened to me. They're flooded with all these responses, both physiological and emotional responses to the shock and trauma. So we do a lot of early crisis work around trying to regain a sense of safety. You know, what do I need in order to feel safer in this situation? What do I need to say no to? What boundaries might she need to put in place to help protect herself? What things does she need to do to check her own physical health? And then once the crisis starts to subside, then we do that deeper trauma work of all those places where it may have wounded her as an individual. So that may be the self-esteem, sexual trauma kind of responses. It may be, you know, not being able to put her history fully together, so working on reclaiming her story and her history. So along with that individual work, then I also like to incorporate group work for partners. This is a very, very isolating place to be for women, for partners, male partners and female partners. So being with other people walking that same walk really helps reduce that sense of being the only one, helps to provide a larger support system. Again, this isn't something you talk to all your neighbors about, so they need a safe place to talk and to really be honest. And so eventually, I think Dan and I would say, then you start working with a relationship and start to help that heal.
So I guess this leads into a question. Can you ever be really cured from sexual addiction?
My suggestion would be no. I think this is like most other addictions, right? It's a lifetime of work. One of the things that we use in my group, one of the terms we use in our group a lot, addiction was a way of life. Recovery is a way of life. You spent hours of your world hiding and being secret to try to act out. Now it's time to spend hours of your world in recovery, rebuilding the life that you wanted, the relationships that you wanted. I don't think it's a curable kind of thing. It's an ongoing battle.
One of the things that I've heard about recently is with the advent of drugs like Viagra, that some sex addicts are using these kinds of drugs as a kind of a sexual pharmacology that becomes a part of their addiction. Have either of you seen this, Barbara?
Yes, I see it. I hear about it from the partners who find their husband's stash of their pills. So absolutely. And they use those outside in terms of part of their acting out routine, or they may need to use that in order to have intimacy within the primary relationship, which we haven't had time to talk about. One of the possible indicators that there may be sexual addiction going on is lack of sexual intimacy in the primary relationship. We'd probably need a whole program just to talk about how that happens. So yes, we see that a lot.
So, Dan, does it ever get to the point that people have engaged in so much porn, so much sexual pharmacology, that a normal sexual relationship just isn't stimulating and it's hard for them to get into that?
Absolutely, yeah. And one of the things, and if you know, if the guys out there listening or women out there listening, and they're saying, you know, this sounds like I have this issue, and I need to go get treatment for it. One of the things that I always say to folks, and they kind of get scared a little bit, is you need at least 60 days, but I try to push for 90 or longer of total abstinence. That's no sexual contact, no masturbation, no sexual release of any kind. What we're really trying to do is reset that sort of arousal template. While we're doing the work to get you to a healthier place, we need to remove all of your escape mechanisms. Most guys are at that spot where they can't have a normal relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's our time. I want to thank our guests, Dr. Barbara Steffens, clinical sexual addiction specialist, who specializes in trauma therapy for partners and addicts, Dan Gabbard, who specializes in men's counseling and a certified sex addiction therapist. You can subscribe to our podcast and hear this conversation again or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore school accreditation both locally and statewide with State Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro. Up to Date is next with a look at how President Obama's race influences his views on our current political landscape. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Susan Wilson, and this is Casey Currents. Keep listening.